Good morning. Few character qualities are more Christ-like than unassuming greatness. This is especially true when the one modeling that trait is extraordinarily gifted and magnificently competent and eminently successful, but at the same time remarkably unassuming and unpretentious. It was back in 1971 that the Lord called me and our family out to Southern California to begin a ministry serving Him at a local church in that vast megalopolis. I didn't realize at the time, but our arrival occurred right when one of those unassuming great men had reached the zenith of his career, and he was in the middle of his most successful time as the head basketball coach at UCLA. His name became, in a matter of a few years, a household word in homes where sport is loved, especially the game of basketball. And all of us out there watched with just eye-opening wonder at the championships he won, but even more significantly at the character of the man himself. His life was filled with a mixture of contrasts. Enormous adulation on the one hand, at the same time, ego-centered athletes who would come on the scene and be under his tutelage as he would add to their life that John Wooden touch. Pauley Pavilion was filled, home game after home game, as these teams came through, and in a matter of years, a whole new squad, and yet again, another championship. It was a pleasure not only to watch him from the distance, but to get to know him up close and personal and realize that none of this turned his head. He was the same man as he had always been and as he is to this day. I suppose that's the reason that I appreciated years later the words written by Rick Riley of Sports Illustrated, who did a piece on him he titled, "A Paragon Rising Above the Madness." Among other things, Riley writes, "There's never been a finer man in American college sport than John Wooden, or a finer coach." He won 10 NCAA basketball championships at UCLA in 12 years, the last in 1975. Nobody has ever come within six of him. He won 88 straight games between January 30, 71 and January 17, 74. Nobody has come within 42 since then. So sometimes when the madness of March gets to be too much, too many players trying to make sports center, too few players trying to make assists, too many coaches trying to be homies, too few coaches willing to be mentors, too many freshmen with out-of-wedlock kids, too few athletes who will stay in school long enough to become men, I like to go see Coach Wooden. I visit him in his little condo in Encino, 20 minutes northwest of L.A., and hear him say things like, "Gracious sakes alive," and tell stories about teaching Lewis the hook shot. Lewis, of course, is Lew Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. "There's never been another coach like wooden. Quiet as an April snow, square as a game of checkers, loyal to one woman all his married life, one school, one way, walking around campus in his sensible shoes and Jimmy Stewart morals. He'd spent a half hour the first day with those athletes practicing how they are to put on their socks. Wrinkles can lead to blisters, he would warn. These huge players would sneak looks at one another and roll their eyes. Eventually, they'd do it right. Good, he'd say. And now, for the other foot. Of the 180 players who played for Wooden, he knows the whereabouts of 172 today. Of course, that's not hard when most of them call checking on his health, secretly hoping to hear some of his simple life lessons so they can write them on the lunch bags of their kids who will roll their eyes. Discipline yourself and others won't have to, Coach would say. Never lie, never cheat, never steal, Coach would say. Earn the right to be confident, Coach would say. You played for him, you play by his rules. Never score without acknowledging a teammate. One word of profanity, you're done for the day. Treat your opponent with respect. He believed in hopelessly out-of-date stuff that never did anything but win 10 championships. No dribbling behind the back or through the legs. There's no need, he'd say. No UCLA basketball number was retired under his watch. Well, what about the other fellows who wore that number? Didn't they contribute to the team then? He'd say. No long hair, no facial hair. It takes too long to dry. You could catch cold. Especially when you leave the gym, Coach would say. That one drove his players bonkers. One day, All-American center Bill Walton showed up with a full beard. It's my right, he insisted. Wouldn't ask if he believed that strongly. Walton said, yes, I do. Well, that's good, Bill. Coach responded, I admire people who have strong beliefs and stick by them. I really do. We're going to miss you. Walton shaved it right then and there. Now Bill Walton calls him once a week just to tell the coach he loves it. Unassuming greatness. Extraordinary gifts, incredible competence. But he never knew how great he was. How refreshing. I failed to mention during those years he was coach, there was never a salary squabble. There was no DWI scandal. No sad story of coach abusing a player. Not one skeleton rattling in the closet about a sexual affair with some other woman, ever. Just unassuming greatness. The best example of all, of course, is Jesus, our Savior. But the 12 disciples seemed like they spent those 3.5 years overlooking that. They were so busy positioning themselves for a place of significance. Mark records a couple of those moments in the life of Jesus with his disciples. The first is in Mark chapter 9 at verse 33, where they have finished a long walk and have come to the town of Capernaum near the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. They go in a house, we read in verse 33, and he begins to question them. What were you discussing on the way? He asks. I wonder if their faces didn't turn a little red. I wonder who would be willing to speak first and admit what the talk was about as they walked single file behind him. Finally, they screwed up enough courage to admit after the silence that they had been discussing with one another which of them was the greatest. stupid discussion. But they were good at those kind of discussions. Who would be number one? Or if you've got to be, then who'd be number two? And right down the line, you don't see it in the text, but I can't believe that there wasn't a deep sigh as he sits down, verse 35, calls them to himself and says, if anyone wants to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all. That's a funny line to give to people who are unashamedly ambitious. But it's true. And if it wasn't enough for them to hear the words, he called a child from the house over to him. Come here, sweetheart. Come here, son. Maybe put a boy on one knee and a girl on the other. Said, whoever receives one child like this in my name receives me. Whoever receives me does not receive me, but him who sent me. Reminds me of the line that appears at the end of Matthew, inasmuch as you have done it unto these, even the least of them, you've done it unto me. I love that. They didn't get it. So turn the page and you'll read a similar account in chapter 10, verse 35, where two of them decide they'll no longer talk to the other 10 about it. They'll just go directly to their leader. And it's James and John. James and John, two of the top three of his most intimate. These sons of Zebedee came up to him, chapter 10, verse 35, and they said, teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask of you. Sounds like something you'd ask one of these profs, doesn't it? Promise you'll do for me whatever I ask you to do. He said, what do you want me to do for you? They have the audacity, after that previous lecture and object lesson, to say, grant that we may sit one on your right and one on your left in your glory. Not the middle seat that's yours, but one on the right, one on the left. I mean, it's only right, Lord, look what we've given up, forgetting what he had given up to come. And he, in his unassuming greatness, said to them, you don't know what you're asking. Sometimes there are answers that great men give that just sort of level us. And we are chagrined. We're just taken aback by them. It's happened to me many times in my life. I'll never forget when I was sitting on the front row in a Greek class and Dr. Lewis Johnson was teaching us Romans and, no, it was Corinthians. We were in Corinthians. And I remember he asked a question out of chapter 11 that, you know, probably the apostles couldn't have answered, but I had the answer. And so I threw my hand in the air almost before he got the question out of his mouth and I began to go into this answer, and you've done this. The longer my answer was, the worse it got. And finally, it sort of drifted into a fog of quietness. And Dr. Johnson said, Mr. Swindoll, you continue with that answer out on that long limb. I'm going to saw you off with a hard set of facts. So I crawled quickly back to the trunk and slid down and stayed quiet for a while. You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink or to be baptized with the baptism with which I am baptized? You don't understand, men. Greatness comes through suffering, through dying to yourself, through surrender, through submission. It comes through a willingness to go wherever and do whatever, whenever, for whatever reason the Father plans. That's greatness. You don't have a clue. Are you able to do this? They said, we're able. 39 tells of their almost impudent response. He says, the cup that I drink, and you shall be baptized with the baptism with which I'm baptized. Symbolic terms referring to their deaths. And what deaths they had. One was exiled as an old man. One was martyred in 44 by Herod. You don't have any idea what the future holds. But to sit on my right or on my left is not mine to give. It is for those to whom it has been prepared. Don't ever forget that. Greatness doesn't come necessarily to the brightest and the best, to those with the highest IQ or those most gifted linguistically or most capable on their feet. It's a character quality. And the Father preserves and reserves that particular position for those He chooses. Now, about now, you might think, well, at least the other 10 stood back and thought, well, we can learn a lot from this. Wrong. Verse 41, hearing this, the 10 began to feel indignant. A strong word, indignant. They were irritated. I mean, what about us? They were aggravated with James and John. Realizing that there was a virtual mutiny starting, Jesus says to them, come here, men. Come over here. Pulls them aside, calls them to himself, and turns the dialogue into a monologue. This is one of those brief discourses that I hope you never forget. He said to them, you know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. Their great men exercise authority over them. Look again at the verse. You know this. In the rank and file of the military and the corporate world and the political world, there is a definite, clearly defined chain of command. There are generals and there are colonels, and there are majors and there are captains, and there are lieutenants and there are sergeants and there are corporals. It's like that in the military world. There are CEOs and COOs and CFOs. In the political world, there are presidents and vice presidents and cabinet members, and it works that way. It's all part of the organizational plan. However, the Greek, with great emphasis, begins the next verse, not so is it among you. Not so. It doesn't work like that in the family of God. There is no status or rank. There is no power play for gaining a position. It's like the psalmist writes, don't lift up your horn on high. Don't blow your own horn. Do not speak with insolent pride, for not from the east, nor from the west, nor from the desert comes exaltation. God is the judge. He puts down one and he exalts another, and it is his sovereign right. Whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, And look at the verbs. He came to serve, and he came to give his life a ransom for many. People like us, would you look around? There's not a one of us even a partially deserving. He came to serve and to give, to serve and to give. I just finished reading again Leighton Ford's outstanding book, Transforming Leadership. In it, he writes this. Several years ago, I had lunch with Richard Dortch, who had just been chosen to become the executive vice president of the PTL Club, a multi-million-dollar religious televangelism network. Dortch had headed his denomination's work in Illinois, had an outstanding track record. I was frankly very impressed with what he had to say and with his seeming sincerity and competence. He planned to recruit a strong finance director and several MBAs to establish some fiscal sanity, as he put it. "It's going to be like turning the Queen Mary around with a teaspoon," he said. "Won't be easy, but I plan to do it." I wished him well and then watched from a distance. Eventually, Jim Baker, the head of PTL, resigned in disgrace over a sexual liaison and its cover-up. Both he and Dortch were convicted for the misuse of funds. How, I wondered. How could a man with such seemingly good intentions go so wrong? So I read with interest a later interview in which he described how the managers of PTL came to define success. Listen to this. Quote, "It is all tied to how many stations we have on our network or how big our building is. It is so easy to lose control, to compromise without recognizing it. At PTL, there was not time taken for prayer or family because the show had to go on. We were so caught up in God's work that we forgot about God." He also talked about the impact of television on preachers. "A television camera," he said, "can change a preacher quicker than anything else. Those who sit on the sidelines can notice the changes in people once they get in front of a camera. It turns a good man into a potentate. It is so easy to get swept away by popularity. Everybody loves you. Cars are waiting for you, and you go to the head of the line. That is the devastation of the camera. It has made us less than what God wanted us to become." In PTL's case, the TV camera, the show, even the ministry itself had become ends in themselves. They were powers which could have been creative, but which in the end actually became destructive. Ford concludes, "For those of us not in the public eye, it's easy to point the finger at the Jim Joneses and the Jim Bakers, but power can be just as seductive to a teacher in a classroom." A physician in an examining room, the boss in a union meeting, or the leader of an average church. We live in a dog-eat-dog world, and it quickly and easily invades the ranks of the religious. So today I come with great hope for you who are looking at this school with your future in mind. But I come today with a word of warning to all of us. Be careful. Walk humbly with your God, regardless of how much you learn and how greatly you be used. Walk humbly with your God, regardless of how well you become known, or however greatly the Lord blesses. Walk humbly with Him. The world has a different counsel. When you're attacked, retaliate. Don't do that. When you're criticized, defend. Don't do that. When you're skilled and gifted, claw and climb your way to the top. Don't do that. Don't do that. You don't need an agent. God will find you. David wasn't busy about making himself known when that giant roamed the slopes of the valley of Elah. God found him. And when he slew the giant, it's wonderful, he didn't quickly go downtown looking for crowns. He went right back with his father's sheep. Unassuming greatness. When others seem equally capable and competent, the world says, compete. Don't do that. It's what the world does. Next time you're tempted to turn your ambition loose, I give you three words. First, remember. Remember. Remember the lifestyle of the people of the kingdom. Remember Jesus' words, it is not so among us. Second, release. Release the controls to God. Release the importance of your reputation. It was Wooden who said this, be more concerned with your character than with your reputation. Your character is what you really are, while your reputation is merely what others think you are. Most folks will think you're better than you are. Do your best to correct them. The closer they get to you, the more they'll realize you're not that great. A few people are, the Woodens, the Tom Landrys, many of these who teach you, but they would never be the ones to say so. So release that. Third, return. Return to the priorities of Jesus to serve and to give. Back when I had the privilege of sitting in the president's office of this great school, one of the high marks was a time I would take to do exit interviews with graduates. It was always refreshing to be with them and to see the product of our teaching and our mentoring and time with them. One particular year was especially meaningful to me because our youngest son came on campus to visit with us. We hadn't seen him for months. He lived in Nashville. Some distance had come between him and me through mistakes I had made, and we were in the process of rebuilding our lives. So it was especially good to have him with me and with us. And he didn't know I was doing exit interviews, and he just kind of followed me around from one thing to another. So when it came time for the interview, it was great for me to sit back, and he was right in the middle. It was terrific. Here were all these hotshot graduates from Dallas Seminary, 8 or 10 of them, and here he was in the middle firing questions. It was great. I watched it, and about an hour or so after the exit interview ended, I was taking him to the airport to get him on his flight back to Nashville. He was really quiet. I said, well, thanks for coming. He said, I loved it, Dad. Really, the best part wasn't being with you, but was being with those graduates. And I said, they're terrific. He said, let me tell you something, Dad. I've never been around a more humble group of men and women in my life. Isn't that great? I was so proud of you. It was such a joy to hear him say that. Never been around a more humble group of men and women in my life. In many ways, it changed his life. At that time, his hair was down to his waist. I remember when I did the wedding for him and his wife, I said, would one of you kiss the bride? I couldn't tell by looking. But... Scout's honor. He went home. He said to Jenny, let's cut this hair off. I mean, not that anybody around here said your hair's too long. The wonderful thought is that nobody said that. That the students put their arms around him and loved him. And in a matter of really months, we began to see a whole difference. We haven't talked about that visit much, but I look back on it as a turning point. By the way, if you had been one of those in that group, would he have had that same response? I hope so. Many wonderful and great men and women have sat where you're sitting. They've come through this school and they've now graduated to serve and to give. And it was here that we learned the basic rudiments of ministry. The best part wasn't in the textbooks. It was in the mentoring. It was in seeing in the lives of those who taught us these kind of things. I said to Cynthia as I put my tie on and got ready for this morning, I said, well, I'm back on a campus. She smiled and said, let's see, when did all this start? I said, back in 1959, we didn't even have any kids. Here we are with 10 grandkids. And she said, and that school is still great. And it is. Unassumingly great. Our Father, in our lives, be glorified. When we survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, our richest gain we count but loss and poor contempt on all our pride. Be glorified in our family. Be glorified in our church. May you be exalted as we are abased. That's what pleases you. And what pleases you is what we want. Help us in these years of learning and growing to get that lesson down clearly. That Christ is to be glorified. And we are to give and to serve. In the name of Jesus. Everybody said.